Record. So do you want to do a little bit about your 7 Plus? Did we talk about that last week?
No, we didn't. I don't think I had it yet. Or okay. Did we? No, I don't think I had it yet. No, because we did, because we didn't record last week.
Yeah. Cool. Okay. So it's Diamond Assets and then just into the show. Okay. Here we go. This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears and I'm joined as always by Bradley Chambers. Tonight we have one sponsor for the show and that is Diamond Assets. And we'll tell you more about them as the show goes on. Bradley, how are you?
Good. Big day here at Chambers headquarters. I had a flu shot today and a teeth cleaning. So, yeah, big day health-wise.
There you go. A little maintenance before the winter. You're now at the same age where you have to treat yourself like your car.
Yeah, no cavities. That's always a good day.
Nice. Yes, you Americans have such perfect teeth. It's not fair.
Yeah, I actually don't pay for it either. I have a great insurance plan for dental. Wow. It's called the family plan, meaning my dentist is my father-in-law.
So, there you go. Great. Do you know you have to pay for dental treatment in the UK?
Do you really?
Yeah. Well, that's why we have such bad teeth, right?
Well, the and honestly, dental coverage, and if you have to pay for it, like dental insurance, I don't think it's worth it because teeth cleanings are not that expensive out of pocket, and
no.
Usually most insurances have a max $1,000 a year out of pocket. So if you get a crown and they won't even pay for all of it. So if you need a crown, you're still going to have to pay $500-$600 on it. So it's like. But by the time you do all that, it's like you might as well just take that money and put it aside in a dental fund.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'm not an insurance happy kind of guy at all. Like not at all. Just
insurance is for risks you can't bear, right?
Well, right. That's exactly right. Eye doctor insurance. Eye coverage. If we need it, I will pay for it out of pocket, and if we don't, I'll save the money.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I'm trying to remember what this deal is in the UK, but I know my wife wears glasses and she has a really complicated prescription. We pay £400 for glasses for her. Most of that's the lens grinding because she's got such a weird eye shape, I think, is, yeah.
So I did get my iPhone 7 Plus today, mm-hmm. or a few weeks, I guess week or so ago. Really, really happy with it. Camera, as everybody knows, is just incredible. And I'm running the beta to get the portrait mode. And I found that, especially in outdoor settings, I found it works really, really well. Of course, you still have some pictures it looks terrible on. But I've taken some photos I just never thought would be possible with the phone. So really, really happy with the phone overall. No home button's been fine. The no physical home button doesn't bother me one bit. Feels great. Just overall. Fantastic device, and I keep going back and forth on whether to buy a Series 2 Apple Watch. I've ordered it twice and canceled it both times, and some just probably, which is probably a sign that I don't need it, that I can't make up my mind. It's like if I can't decide that I need it, then I don't need it. The main thing I want it for is running, but I run with my phone anyways, and so it's like, what's the benefit of having that if I'm always going to keep my phone with me?
Yeah, no, I think it really. For me, the Series 2 kind of really stretches out to appealing to the hardcore sporting person, the swimmer, the trail runner that you're going so far and so long that you can't possibly carry the weight of a phone with you, etc. But I saw one thing on Twitter. Somebody had shown a workout they had done where they'd been surfing, and it showed all the different sort of surfing rides they had taken, with the GPS back into the shore. I thought that was a pretty cool application, and it was just a running tracking application, I think. But there's an opportunity there to make a really cool surfing tracker application as well.
I'm hearing some of the reviews I'm reading are kind of questioning some of the results from the GPS, and they're using a GPS watch, and then they're using the Apple Watch, and then some of these are off a decent amount, enough where it would dramatically affected your pace. And so obviously some people won't care about that. If you're really into fitness, and you're a runner, your pace really matters. And so I don't know. We'll see. I don't know. It's hard to gauge how accurate it is.
I wonder if that's something that software might correct with a bit more information.
It certainly could. And I was kind of brainstorming with a friend of what the Apple Watch might look like in 5 years. And it's you really can just see a place where this comes built in with cellular. And I know with T-Mobile, they have iCloud syncing of cellular activity. So if I get a phone call, I can set it up where all my devices that are signed into iCloud can take and receive phone calls through my T-Mobile service. And so if I leave my phone at home, I could actually take phone calls, not just FaceTime calls, but phone calls on my Mac. And so you can see like where that, like, I don't find that very useful to do because that just can get annoying, but you can see a future where you're what you just like don't carry your phone with you a lot of places and you just leave it at home. And like you know, you could take phone calls and send messages via Siri on your phone that has a cellular connection. And so like your wrist is basically the new smartphone. I'm just, you know, again, more brainstorming.
AirPods, of course, really have a part to play in that as well.
Yeah, exactly. And so, and I mentioned on the show, I'm really more interested in the future of AirPods, where I actually still think voice is like the worst form of input. It's slow, mm-hmm. and I can type way faster than I can ever speak. And it's like if it doesn't work 100% of the time, to me it's just useless. Like, I'm not really interested in, you know, automating my home where I can say, "Hey Siri, turn on the lights." Like, to me, it's just easier to hit the switch. In some ways, takes less brain power. But I'm more interested in like artificial intelligence when it can proactively tell me things. Like if I'm having coffee and I have an AirPod in, like it can say, "Hey Bradley, traffic's getting heavy. You probably need to leave for your next appointment. You know, hey, don't forget your anniversary's coming out next week. You probably should go ahead and order a present." Things like that. And that's more to me what I'm interested in long term with a lot of this technology around AI. I've never used Siri on my Mac. I use Siri like some in the car, but like to me, using Siri like at home, it's just always faster to me just to look it up or type it out or something.
Yeah, I think I kind of agree with you. The thing with speech input as well is that it's tiring. It's physically tiring to use. Along, you know, people who do a lot of, you know, computer-based dictation, they'll tell you that your voice does get tired. You know, and, I mean, teachers know this, right? You get to the end of the day, you're actually shattered. Now you're going to stand on your feet and talk all day, and that's that can be pretty tiring. So it's interesting. I think I agree with you that, you know, whether it's AI or not, just some cleverly programmed system that can alert you to things, you know. I mean, is like the calendar stuff AI that tells you the traffic's getting heavy? I don't really think that is AI. It's probably just, you know, people say that AI is whatever computers can't do yet, you know, and as soon as computers get to be able to do it, it's not very exciting. It doesn't deserve that name anymore. So it'll be interesting to see how that develops. I know just on the day we're recording, Google has announced some new phones, and I haven't really read all the information there yet, but they're clearly betting heavily on AI as being the differentiating factor for their platform and their phones, because the phones kind of look, you know, they're just rectangular slabs of glass, same as any other, but it'll be interesting to see how that goes.
Well, yeah, because to me, if I want to know, like, what the weather is, like, oftentimes, like, my wife, if she's putting the kids to bed, she'll yell at me and say, like, you know, what's the low tonight? And I can either like stop what I'm doing and say, "Hey Siri," and then ask it, "Hey Siri, what's the weather? What's the low tonight?" And then it'll take a second, it'll tell me. Or I could just pick up my phone or even a watch and just tap on dark sky and look. Like, which is faster and which takes less energy? Like, brain power.
Watch complications are fascinating in that respect. You know, if you have a watch face full of little icons that constantly update and tell you that stuff, then you just look at your wrist and go, "Oh, 12 or whatever, you know.
Well, and it's obviously like if you're cooking and you need to know something, like you don't have free hands, like that's one thing. But like for, so I don't know. But that's, those are all interesting things. I think this was actually in iOS 9, I believe, where you could put like the address into the calendar. Your calendar appointment, and then it like your phone will like alert you and tell you kind of what the traffic is, when you should leave. And then I know this is new with iOS 10, where it has map destinations, and like I absolutely love that. I think it's actually on the device, because it took me a few days when I got my new phone for it to kind of figure out what I was doing. But like, I go to a men's Bible study every Wednesday night. Well, like it tells me, it learns where I'm going and says, "Hey, just, you know, traffic's light or traffic's a little heavy, take this route." You know, right now it says 13 minutes to get home, come at work. In the morning it says like 15 minutes to get to work. It tells me which way to take. I love that. That is fantastic to me.
Yeah, I think Apple's doing a lot of very effective stuff. But I think I've said this before to you, Bradley, but I feel like they're not talking enough about it. You know, I keep noticing things in iOS 10 where I'm saying, "Oh, already knows that. That's pretty clever." You know, things like, if I search for a contact in the contacts application, it also finds people with that name in mail, for example. And The other one is in the calendar app in iOS 10, it can suggest to you locations for events that you've had before. So I had an example where we'd been to a rugby match and I was putting in another one, and it suggested to me the stadium that the game was going to be at, you know. And that was a pretty cool, you know, again, is that AI? Is that machine learning? Is that just a very clever search pattern? You know, I don't know. Neither do I really care, but it's useful, right? It doesn't have to be AI to be useful. It just has to correctly anticipate and reliably satisfy your needs at the time you want it. And I think it's really to do with that kind of, it's there when you want it sort of thing, rather than, oh, it's up in your face that you've got to buy into a whole assistant interface. And I think that's perhaps the difference for me, is that I like seeing little bits of it spread around everywhere that's useful, rather than having to kind of commit to Siri, for example, you know. And that's that kind of intelligence, whether artificial or just cleverly programmed, moving outside of the Siri kind of silo, if you like, and out into little bits in every app, that's starting to become actually much more useful than Siri for me.
Yeah, I agree. I 100% agree. Before we get onto today's topic, which has been requested from multiple listeners, I want to thank our sponsor for tonight. It's the fine folks at Diamond Assets. Now, their website is diamond-assets.com, and we'll have a link to that in the show notes. But they exist to support schools in their efforts to capture the residual value of their existing fleet of Apple products. All too often, schools miss out on taking advantage of the existing value of their equipment, and Diamond Asset serves to help you avoid that mistake. The process is simple. You request a quote, you schedule a pickup, you join them for a reconciliation call, and then you receive your payment for your equipment. They're a full-service IT asset recovery company. They offer a complete range of services for their customers, including buyback, white glove pickup, flexible scheduling, serial number audits, reconciliation reports, customer support, and labeling and coding of merchandise, inventory tracking, as well as data erasure for all Apple hardware products. By combining white glove services, enhanced trade-in values, and a dedicated account management team, Diamond Assets has allowed school districts across the U.S. to take full advantage of one of the most unique trade-in programs the industry has to offer. If you're considering a refresh of your Apple fleet or just want to get rid of some old iPads or Macs, give them a call, or you can check out their website, diamond-assets.com, and their Twitter handle is at diamondassetsit. This is a pretty neat company. I think this is true. A lot of schools don't realize, like, when they're refreshing gear, especially if they're refreshing every 3 years, especially if they bought like pretty good iPads at the time, those like have a lot of value and can really help you. Let's say, for example, you could sell your existing deployment and like maybe buy a higher storage upgrade on your next deployment, because you would have that, you know, kind of incoming cash you could, you know, pay towards that, or maybe it buys all the cases for your next deployment, just something like that. So definitely don't let that stuff sit in the closet. It's just getting worth less and less over time. So check out Diamond Assets at diamond-assets.com. Tonight is something that I am no expert on whatsoever, and you are, and so that makes it kind of a perfect show. I'm actually just going to sign off now and let you talk. We're going to talk about the JSS API, or the Casper Suite API, because we've talked about this a little bit, or you have, and mentioned some of the things that you've done, and had some listeners email in wanting more information about that. So that's the topic for tonight's show.
Yeah, so I kind of made allusion to this back when we were kind of in the throes of deployment, kind of middle of August and so on. I mentioned on the show that I had written a number of scripts to do some basic things against the JSS API, and well, this is going to be probably a pretty technical topic, and I'll try and keep it simple enough, but if you actually want to do anything with this, it sort of presupposes that you know how to write computer programs, so it may or may not be appropriate for everybody here. But basically, at its simplest, the JSS is the Casper Suite JAMS software server. It's our mobile device management server that you and I both use, Bradley, and many other people do as well. And API, in computer science terms, is short for Application Programming Interface. And what that is it's a number of functions that are made available by JAMS software as part of your Casper installation that you can then write scripts and you can call these functions and do things to your JSS server. And what I mentioned that I had done before was I had written both a Python library and some scripts Which I've made available. We'll put the link in the show notes. I've made it available on GitHub for your interest. And in there, what I've done is I've written a number of what you might call wrapper functions around certain things in the GSS. So if you want to write a Python script, you can call a function that says, you know, get all mobile devices, and my code will go away, get those devices from your GSS and return them to you as a Python list, and then you can search or manipulate them however you want to do. So what I wanted to do in this show, Bradley, was just to try and talk about the kind of conceptual level of, you know, what is the API, what's it good for, when, under what circumstances would you use it, and what are the things to kind of watch out for, and so on. So yeah. If I lose you at any point, please ask me a question, and we'll try and get back on track. So at the lowest level, like what is the GSS API and what's the point of it? Well, basically, it's a lower level way to access the GSS. Now most people who listen to the show will know about, you know, logging into the website and clicking on things and assigning, you know, devices to groups and configuration profiles to devices and apps to devices and so on. But the API is a kind of, it lets you kind of get underneath that level, and it lets you write code that will manipulate all those different structures in the big database, which is essentially what the GSS is a huge big database underlying a web application. And you can write code, I suppose you can write in any language, right? But I've mostly used Python for this. And the API is what's called a REST API. So in web terms, what you do is you interact with the API by making HTTP requests to your server. And those requests have to be in specific formats. They have to provide specific information. And the information varies depending on what it is you're trying to do. And we'll talk about a few of those examples in a little bit. But essentially, you're writing a script that sends network requests to your server, and in response to those network requests, the server will do something. Maybe either create a new record or delete a record or update an existing one or return you a list of records if you're doing a search query as well. So the way I got started with this, and the way that most people get started, is if you go to your server's URL, so, you know, mymdm.school.uk/API, what there is there is a very friendly and colourful sort of practice page, if you like, which lists all the things you can do with the API. And then if you click on any of them, it expands out and you can try a basic call to that. And at first glance, it looks like anybody can rock up to that URL and just do something. But as soon as you try and make a request, it asks you for a password. So it is authenticated, and it does actually work against your live data as well. So do be careful with it. Don't just go nuts. It's not a test environment. It is working against your actual GSS. And how you work with this in the sort of form of REST programming is that you use the different verbs in the HTTP standard to manipulate different objects in different ways. So you would do an HTTP GET to search for objects, a POST to create objects, a PUT to update existing objects, and an HTTP DELETE command to delete objects. And you can do most of those. There are usually wrappers for various languages to make it simpler than you having to open a raw socket and start talking to your GSS. So in Python, there's one called the requests library, which is what I've used in my library. And that's pretty effective, and it takes it down to one or two lines of code to make any of these requests to your server and get something done. So with that kind of understanding in the background, you're talking about writing a script and you're talking about making web calls across the internet to your server. What kind of things in your server can you actually work with through the API? And the answer is most things. It's quite surprisingly comprehensive. And I would not be surprised to discover that a lot of the actual GSS web application works through that API to do its job. So you can work with all kinds of things, including if you're thinking about setting up a GSS from scratch, you can start to work with infrastructure type things, such as GSS has got a concept of sites and buildings and network segments and departments. And these are all things that you might set up in response to, a list of say, rooms that you have, for example, or something like that in a building, you might put together certain things like that. So you might have that in a list, and you could maybe write a script that would just go ahead and generate those for your GSS, for example. You can also create iBeacons. Now, we haven't really done a lot about iBeacons, Bradley, I don't think, when we've talked about GSS before, but you can create you can place iBeacons in your building, basically, and then you can put them into the GSS, and when devices encounter that iBeacon, you can make things happen. And one of the things about iBeacons is each one of them has a very long, unique ID, and that's something you have to load into GSS. So, for example, if you were a university and your latest project was to, you know, pepper the campus with iBeacons, and you had maybe like 300 or 400 loaded into GSS, how are you going to do that? You're going to just type in 300 or 400 times a long identifier and possibly get them all right? I don't think so. So perhaps write a script that will create a number of iBeacons in your GSS in response to, you know, maybe parsing a CSV file or something in Python, which is a couple of lines of code, and then calling your API to create all those iBeacons for you as network segments in your GSS. So this is just a kind of first example of what you might do in terms of making an automated feature that doesn't exist in GSS by itself. Like, there's no mass import function for iBeacons, but you could script that without too much difficulty. If you had a sufficiently large iBeacon project that it made it sense for you to spend, I don't know, 30 minutes or something creating a script that would do that job for you. With me so far, Bradley?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, cool. So in terms of other things you can do, and you can certainly do a lot of things with computers as well, because don't forget the GSS, the Casper Suite also lets you administer Macs, but mainly we're talking about administering iOS things here. So you can start to work with mobile devices through the API as well. So one of the calls you can make is just a call called mobile devices. And if you do an HTTP GET against that command, what you can do is you can just list all the devices in your GSS. And it comes back, by default, that comes back with some key identifying information, such as the device name, battery level, unique identifiers, MAC addresses, all that kind of thing. And also, one of the ways that the GSS API works is it really wants you to work with the internal ID number that you don't actually, I think you can see it in your interface, but you tend not to really pay attention to it because it doesn't mean anything to you. But every device, every user, every app has got an internal ID number in the GSS. And you can grab that from these records that are returned. And then you can say, okay, show me more information about the device with this ID, for example. And that's, you know, you would then see other information about what applications are installed and blah, blah, blah. All the things that you could normally see about a particular device, you can call various APIs to script that information and pull it down into your script and then do something with it. There are also things, you can do things like get the device's history, for example. So let's say you were in a situation where you maybe get thousands of devices in the field, right? And sometimes a certain command fails. You might want to know how many devices across our whole fleet has this particular command failed on. And that's not something that would be particularly easy to see in the GSS interface itself. You'd be looking at the lists of commands for each individual device. But what you could do is you could write a script that goes ahead and looks at the mobile device history of all your devices. Might take a while to run, but it would work. And then you could filter that list in your program for anywhere where one of the failed commands is, I don't know, set the device name, let's say, and why are some of them failing and some of them not. And you could write a program that would create a list of the device names of all the devices where that command has failed, and you might see something in common there. You might not, but that's an example where you could do a very kind of detailed and specific filtering job that is not particularly easy to do in the user interface itself, but then you could write the program that would do that, for example. You can also work with applications, and this is something that I found very useful when I was migrating to a new GSS installation for this deployment. One of the things that I wanted to do was I wanted to make sure that all of the applications could be device assigned. And there's a flag that you have to switch on in order to do that. Now, when I When I uploaded our VPP token, you know, we've got like 250 different apps. And the prospect I was looking at, and this was actually the task that got me into scripting the API, was I was going to have to click into every single application and click on a particular tab and then click on a particular switch and then save it. And I thought, I'm really not doing that like 1,000 times. I'm not clicking 1,000 times to get that job done. So what I did was I started to script, and I firstly, you know, got a list of all the mobile device applications that were in the GSS. And then I used another call to set some of the properties there. And in particular, I set this device assignment flag. And that was one of the scripts that I wrote back in the early days. So that's an example of something where if I want to just do one operation to, you know, 250 different applications, I can do that with a script. And it runs in like 2 seconds, whereas that would be hours of work to manually set that on every application in the GSS. So a lot of this is about time saving, really, when you've got to do some kind of mass thing to all of these devices or all of the applications that you've got in your GSS as well. Another thing that I've done with mobile device applications is to try and get a feeling for or do a survey of what apps do I have, like very simply give me a list of applications, and what are the version numbers that the GSS knows about. So to try and make sure that the GSS has synced up with the VPP properly, I can, you know, run a script that's got, gives me a list of all the apps and all the version numbers. And that's also really helpful, for example, when people want to know, like, what apps do you have? I can run that script and, you know, it can spit out a CSV file I can then save as in a spreadsheet, for example, and give it to people. And that gives folk an idea of what applications are available to them, for example. What else can you do there? What else have I done? The other thing you can do with mobile devices is you can manipulate things about the device themselves. So, for example, one thing that a lot of people want to know how to do, and there's actually a script in the GitHub repository for this, is you know, when I talked about when we did the deployment, Bradley, I had installed all my devices into GSS. And they were all enrolled, but they had not been assigned to any user. But what I did was I created a CSV file with a serial number and a username and a full name. And then I wrote this script that would parse that file. It would create a user in the GSS, set the user's name, email address, and username. And then it would also assign that user to a specific serial number device. So I was kind of searching, I was creating a user and then searching for the device with that serial number and then setting the assigned user of that device to the person that I just created. So that was a very quick and easy way to go from essentially an empty GSS with enrolled devices to a GSS that was full of users based on my spreadsheet export, basically. And then all those devices were also assigned to a user as well. So that was a pretty cool thing to be able to do. And the thing I liked about that was it was very data-driven and it was very reliable. So all I had to do was recreate that spreadsheet export, the CSV file, if I made a mistake. And I, of course, wrote another script that would just delete all the users from the GSS as well. Do be careful with that script if you try it. It will actually do what it says. So what I could do is I could just run, you know, delete all users and just blow away everything I had done, and then do create all users, and it would create all the users again. And I was able to redeploy the whole suite, you know, 2 or 3 times if I wanted to, just by running those commands as well. So there's a lot of useful things you can do with that. Extension attributes are pretty powerful too. I don't know if you use many extension attributes in your GSS, Bradley?
I don't think I do.
Yeah, so an extension attribute is basically you can add an additional field onto an object. So I've certainly used them on users, and I've used them on... I don't think I'm using them on devices at the moment. But there's two things. I use two extension attributes on a user. One is to have a role for the user, which is either staff or student. And that way I can create a smart group that says all the staff and one that says all the students. And I can do things like, for example, with Apple Classroom, right? You have to deliver Apple Classroom or the Apple Classroom app through your GSS. And then what I would do is I would scope that to all the staff. And that was only just the users whose role attribute was staff. Now, there's no built-in role attribute in GSS. I created that. And then whenever I create a staff member, I set their role to be staff. And what that means is that they get put into the teachers group, they get sent the proper teacher configuration for Apple Classroom, and everything works correctly for them, and no students get the Apple Classroom as a teacher. So that's kind of how that works. And that's one useful use for role. The other way I use role, or the other way I use extension attributes, is I have one called graduation year. And this is like a stable identifier or stable grouping identifier for all the users. So for staff, I just leave it blank, but for students, I put in their year of graduation. And then that lets me create groups for each year, or, you know, merge groups. For example, if you have a composite class, primary one and two, I can say, well, that class is users where the graduation year is 2028 or 2029. And the union of both of those groups appears as that class, for example. So that helps me create, for example, in Apple Classroom, it helps me create friendly looking and appropriate size user groups for teachers to look at, without them having to remember, oh, I'm, you know, this is class of 2019 sitting in front of me here. I can actually give it a friendly name. And of course, you know, those classes, those composite classes, might not be the same over time. So instead of going in and changing every user's class attribute, I go in and just change the class. And based on the user's year of graduation attribute, they either enter or leave the class grouping. So that way I don't have to edit every user every year. I just have to change the classes. And that's roughly how that works. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Extension attributes are really cool. And you can do anything with them, right? So for example, like another way you could cut this, I haven't done this myself, but I've heard it done, is you could have like a behavior status on a user. And then if the user is in trouble for some reason, you could set their behavior status to some appropriate level. And then you might automatically scope configuration profiles to be applied to users whose behavior status is in a particular state. So for example, if somebody's giving you a problem with a camera, for example, it shuts them down, or it gives them a blacklist for applications or something, so they only get to use, you know, work apps and no games or something like that. You could do something like that as well. That's really useful. You can do extension attributes on devices as well. So you might go in and say, well, you know, these are staff devices, for example, and that would be a way to identify staff devices versus student devices. And that was actually something I ran into this week, because we just bought some staff devices for the first time under device enrollment. And previously what I had been doing is I had been identifying student devices by saying student devices are any devices that are supervised, and staff devices are not supervised. But now, because we've got them in DEP, staff devices are also supervised. So when our first staff member started enrolling their devices, they were starting to get hit with the kind of punishment profiles, because they hadn't, for example, set up self-service properly at that point. So the server was being kind of quite aggressive in managing their configuration. And I had to think about doing something to take the staff devices out of that scope. So I've still got a bit of tweaking to do in that respect, because that's a new kind of problem that I haven't had before. But that's a nice problem to have. So, where are we? GSS users, we talked about those. You can create users, you can create groups. You can also create configuration profiles. Now, it's not super easy to actually like generate a configuration profile with rules and put it in there. But what you can do, for example, is you can manipulate the scope. So if you had, you know, a reason why you might want to scope a configuration profile to a long list of individual users that can't be put in a group for some reason, then you could actually write a script that adds them all to the scope, for example, that kind of thing. Not obvious to me why you would want to do that. I can't think of a good reason, but you could, for example, script the creation of a group, right? So the creation of static groups is another thing that you could script, and you could build it up that way as well. Some other ideas for using the API. One of the ones that I've written, I can't remember if it's in the GitHub repository or not, but a script that calculates the average used space across all devices. So that's, again, that kind of summary information is not something that GSS is particularly good at showing you directly. But for example, what I would do there is I would just list all the devices, and then for each device, I would just, you know, check its free space attribute. and add that to a running average, and then you know you can do that by class group or whatever, or by the whole fleet. And that's quite useful information. You know, that kind of aggregate information is the kind of thing that you want to know about in terms of, you know, when it comes to the next deployment, what do you need to get? And having done something like that a bit earlier, that was what told me, for example, that we didn't need to go to 128 gig iPads for our next deployment. The 32 was actually fine for most people. And so far it seems to have been. Detailed searches across devices, that's another thing you can do with this. You can, if you want to search for the existence of, say, a particular app, you could script that. You can actually do that one in the GSS user interface as well. But let's say you had five apps you wanted to search for. You could do them all at once, for example, something like that. So the GSS is pretty useful. The API is pretty useful. If you have any kind of unusual data source that you want to connect with the GSS as well, scripting is a pretty good way to do that. So if you, I'm trying to think of a good example here, but if you had, trying to think, student databases might be one, okay? And effectively that's what I was doing when I was exporting people from our Google Sheets as a CSV file and then importing that into GSS. That's effectively what I was writing there, not a very sophisticated one, but it worked. You could do other such things like that as well. What else? I suppose you could actually, if you really wanted to, you could script the scoping and unscoping of games according to some schedule, right? So people always want this feature, and some other NDMs do have this, where some apps are available at certain times and some apps are not. Now, GSS doesn't really support timed profiles, but you could, for example, write a script which would say at 9 in the morning, it would push a blacklist profile to everybody, and then at 3 o'clock it would take that profile away and people would have all their apps back again. So you could do something like that if you wanted to. And obviously you'd sort of run that against, you know, on some kind of time schedule like cron or launch services or something like that on the Mac as well. So that was kind of how I got into that, and that's the kind of thing I've done. There's other things you can do in there. I certainly haven't mentioned all of the things you can do, but those are just some of the examples. The other thing to mention is that there's a couple of really good videos on YouTube about the GSS API. The Jamf Nation User Conference, which goes off every year in October, from last year, from the 2015 conference, there were a couple of really good talks, one called something like Make Your GSS Feel New Again with the API, and the other one was called Using the REST API in an Education Environment. And both of those kind of also inspired me to think about, well, how could I use that in school as well? So those are some of the ways in which you can use that. I haven't done a lot of GSS scripting since our deployment. It was mostly kind of preparatory work at the moment. And most of the rest of what I need to do, I can do day-to-day by clicking in the UI, because I'm not doing those sort of mass setup things anymore. I'm doing individual tweaks nowadays. But for example, with those new staff devices, what I might do there is I might script the creation of extension attribute and set it across 20 devices or whatever, just to save me some time and keep me in practice as well.
Yeah, we'll have links to those in the show notes at outofschool.net as well.
Yeah, so that's the API. It's probably the most technical topic we've done so far. And it's kind of hard to do a podcast about code, but I encourage you to please feel free to do whatever you want with those scripts on GitHub. Fork them, use them. Just be careful of the ones that say delete, because they really do delete. That's it. That's all I've got on the API right now.
Well, good deal. Well, we'll end the show there for this week. We'll have, again, links to everything we talked about in the show notes at outofschool.net. Thanks to Diamond Assets for sponsoring the show this week. And so check them out if you're looking to refresh your Apple deployment in the next year. And they'll do great buybacks for you. I'm Bradley Chambers, as always. You can find me on Twitter at Bradley Chambers. And my sparsely updated blog is at chambersdaily.com.
Cool. And I am Fraser Spears on Twitter and spears.org on the web.
Have a good week, everybody.